Hello and welcome to Digital Insights, featuring topics from the BoagWorld.com blog. My name is Paul Boag, and on this podcast I offer advice on user experience and digital transformation. Today I want to talk to you about the impact of cognitive load and how it's causing problems on your website. There's a very famous experiment that perfectly demonstrates the problem with cognitive load, and you can watch it as a video on YouTube, and I recommend that you do it. It shows two teams of people, one wearing black and the other wearing white. Each team has a basketball and they're passing it between their own team members while constantly moving in and out of other players of both teams. The viewer is asked to count the number of times the white team members pass the ball, a challenging task with all the movement going on. In fact, it's so challenging that over 50% of viewers are concentrating so hard that they completely miss a man dressed as a gorilla, prominently walking into the foreground of the video, beating his chest, and then walking off. That is the impact of cognitive load. The relevance of this to us as web designers is immediately apparent. If a gorilla can become invisible to users when they're overwhelmed, then so can our critical call to action on our website. Suddenly, our inherent desire as designers to keep things clean and simple makes so much more sense. We're trying to reduce cognitive load. Every item you add to an interface increases cognitive load and reduces the chance of users seeing and processing more essential elements. That can obviously have a devastating impact on your conversion rate and site usability. But this is not just about users missing essential screen elements. Cognitive load also impacts how users feel about your website too. Websites that require us to think feel like hard work. That we resent using them, and that makes us view the site negatively. But it has another intriguing consequence too. It also makes us distrust the website. Interestingly, according to research that's been done, if people are under increased cognitive load, we see a decrease in the amount of trust they're willing to place in the associated activities. In other words, people stop trusting your site, and as we know, trust is essential if we want users to believe your messaging and ultimately complete your call to action. So what do we do about all of this? It's not just simply a matter of removing screen elements. Yes, reducing visual clutter does make a big difference, but not every interface can be simple. Some tasks are, by their nature, complicated. Also, an interface doesn't come with an intrinsic level of cognitive load. There are other factors at play too, factors such as how familiar people are with the interface that you are creating. If you can drive a car, do you remember what it was like when you learnt? It was a painful process with so much to concentrate on simultaneously. You had to watch the road, check your mirrors, steer, change gear, at least in Europe, and signal. After years of driving, however, it's entirely possible to arrive at work with no memory of the trip. That's because it's become so familiar, the entire process has become automatic. That's why people love using sites like Amazon and Facebook. It's not that their interfaces are particularly well designed, they're just very familiar. Using services like this have become automatic. It also explains why Amazon has never substantially redesigned its website in one go. Instead, it's evolved it over time. They know that if they did redesign in one go, they'd break users' mental model of how their site works and substantially increase the cognitive load of their users. Facebook hasn't been quite as good at learning this lesson and paid the price on several occasions. Every time they made a big change to their site, inevitably caused a backlash, despite the differences often being an improvement in the user interface. And that's because it broke that sense of familiarity and made people think more. However, inevitably, after a few weeks, that backlash would die down as people became familiar with the new approach and new autonomous pathways were formed. Of course, that only works if users are locked in enough to your site to encourage them to endure. Often, it's easier just to switch to another service. So there are six lessons that we can learn from a user's need for familiarity. First of all, we should follow Amazon's example and incrementally evolve our sites, giving users time to adapt to each change rather than overwhelming them with many changes at once, in the same way as the gorilla video overwhelmed people with a lot of information going on. Number two, If we do redesign, we need to do so with care. Let's be honest, redesigns cannot, and in many cases should not, always be avoided. And there are things that can be done to reduce cognitive load if we do redesign. For example, we can mirror the previous site as much as possible, especially in terms of where content is found. And if possible, we can allow users to switch back to the old design, at least temporarily, to give them a sense of control over the change. We could also highlight changes to returning users by tagging them with cookies before they switch over. And that means that we can provide them with a simple onboarding process for the new site. However, whatever we do, some users will complain and you will see a decline in repeat traffic. If we don't explain that to stakeholders, we may find that they lose their nerve and start blaming the poor design when all they needed to really do is just wait it out until people adjusted. Number three, we should seek to ensure consistency and predictability in our interfaces. Whether you're evolving or redesigning your site, you should seek to ensure consistency across it and conform to users' expectations of what will happen. If the users come to expect your website to behave in a certain way, don't deviate from that. Consistency in your user interface and labeling is crucial, and that's where something like a design system can be useful. Number four, we should conform to reoccurring user interface patterns. I see a lot of articles these days complaining that all websites are starting to look the same. And although I sympathise with this position because it is making the industry stagnant, we need to understand that there is a time and a place for design innovation. Look, I'm a fan of experimental design, but we need to recognise that those kinds of designs do increase cognitive load and so are not always appropriate. If users have come to expect certain user interface patterns because they've seen them across multiple sites, we should think carefully before deviating from that. Number five, we should be embracing inclusive design. And this is an interesting one, because one of the best ways of reducing cognitive load is to design with accessibility in mind. By making a site accessible, especially to those with cognitive disabilities, you also reduce the cognitive load for all. Take, for example, the copy on your websites. We need to keep the language as simple as possible or replace the text entirely with an infographic. Complicated ideas and language are unfamiliar, and that makes it harder for them to be read. By using familiar, simple language, we help those with dyslexia and other cognitive disabilities, but we also make our pages more accessible to scan for the rest of us. But it's not just about familiarity. Mood can also impact cognitive load too. Our mood has a somewhat complicated impact on how we think and by extension how we use a website. Being in a lousy mood actually can be beneficial in some circumstances. For example, we make fewer mistakes when we're filling out a form if we're in a bad mood. The reason for this is that the negative mindset causes us to be more analytical and therefore pay more attention. And by extension, being in a positive mood encourages us to be more intuitive, acting on a more subconscious and instinctual level. That means that being in a positive mood can reduce cognitive load because we're behaving more autonomously. So what does all of this mean for us as web designers? Well, first, it means that if your site is unfamiliar to users and the consequences of making mistakes are relatively low, then it pays to put users in a positive frame of mind. Second, we know that people are inherently lazy when it comes to thinking. They tend to avoid it. And that means if your calls to action require a big decision of any kind, then they will delay it. By putting them in a good mood, they will analyze the decision less, so reducing their cognitive load and increasing the chances of them converting. And that's where design delighters become crucial. There is a trend at the moment towards usability and focusing on that. And don't get me wrong, that is massively important. But aesthetic design is important too, whether it's humorous microcopy or design Easter eggs or some satisfying interaction animation. Design can lift our mood and so reduce cognitive load. The impact of mood on cognitive load also helps us make a case for adequate user research. If we don't correctly understand a user's mood, we can't understand the level of cognitive load they're under. Also, cognitive load is not just limited to what's going on within the user interface. External distractions also play a part, which is why we must understand people's circumstances, and that encourages us to do in-field research. However, there is one more area that impacts the cognitive load of our users, which is whether they've been primed correctly. Our expectations impact our level of cognitive load. If our expectations don't match our experience, then this causes a higher level of cognitive load. For example, if we expect a transaction on a website to be fast and it's not, our level of cognitive load increases and we're more likely to abandon. However, if we go in expecting the process to take some time, then we experience less of a cognitive load and are more likely to persevere. We can manage users' expectations by preparing them adequately. This is also known as priming. We can use priming in all kinds of ways to influence behavior, making decisions feel more intuitive and more natural. For example, in experiments, supermarkets have found that if they play French music in the store, they increase the sales of French wine and reduce the sales of wine from other countries. So this principle of priming has some interesting ramifications for us as web designers. And let's be honest, not all of them are particularly ethical. But we can use priming for good too. We can use it to prepare people for their experience in our app or website. Not only can priming be used to prepare a user for a more complicated interaction, but it can also be used to improve a person's understanding by gently shifting their mental model. Let me give you an example. If I said to you, Jim is going to the bank, what do you imagine? Chances are you'll think Jim is going to a bank to complete a financial transaction. That's because most of us associate the word bank with money. But if I first of all talked about fishing, then you might conclude that Jim was going to the riverbank. I've primed you to think about water. Understanding this can be useful when labeling navigation. If we prime users to think about a specific subject, that will influence how they interpret the labeling, and that can in turn reduce their cognitive load because we've put people on the right track. In some ways, this podcast has taught you nothing new. You probably knew that you should be simplifying your interfaces and that putting people in a positive mood was desirable. It's hardly mind-blowing that creating a sense of familiarity improves usability. But cognitive load explains why these things are good, and that's important when we're talking to stakeholders. So the next time a client asks you to add too much information to a page, show them the Invisible Gorilla video. Only then will they grasp the impact that cognitive load has and why we need to work hard to reduce it.